When we emerged from the gates to the tomb, I paused to glance into the east, and I saw that the roseate harbingers of the dawn were already straining the eastern sky. Then I looked down the ranks of men and realized that many of them were reeling with exhaustion. Zaras had been correct in both respects. I hurried to the gangplank of the third trireme, and as I reached the deck, there was the sound of trumpets and of chariot wheels fast approaching from the direction of the river and the city on its far bank. I hurried to the ship's rail and peered into the darkness across the plain. There was torchlight and such commotion out there that could mean only one thing. Pharaoh had received my message and had returned to Thebes. My heart beat faster, as it always does when I know that the royal presence is near. I ran back down the gangplank, shouting for additional torches and for an honor guard to assemble, but Pharaoh was too quick for me. His chariot came thundering out of the night, with the rest of his squadron strung out behind him. Pharaoh had the reins wrapped around his wrists, and when he saw me, he shouted a joyous greeting and leaned back on the reins. "Well met, Taita! We have missed you!" He threw the reins to his co-driver and jumped down to the ground while the wheels were still turning. He kept his footing like the skilled charioteer he is, and he reached me in a dozen swift strides. He seized me in a crushing embrace and swung me off my feet in front of all my men, oblivious to my dignity. But I can forgive him anything, and I laughed with him. "Indeed, Majesty, it has been far too long. An hour without your presence is like a week without sunshine." He set me on my feet and looked about him with an inquiring expression. I saw now that he was filthy with the dust and grime of a hard campaign, but that he was invested also with the grace and nobility of a true pharaoh. He saw his sisters waiting to greet him and pay their respects. He embraced them both in turn, and then came back to me. He pointed out the three great triremes lying at the wharf. "What ships are these? Even with their masts unstepped and their oars shipped, they are twice the size of any other I have ever seen before. Where did you find them, Taita?" The message I had sent him was cryptic and devoid of details. However, he did not wait to receive my answers to his questions, but he went on immediately. "And who are all these ruffians? I sent you off with a handful of men, and you return with your own little army, Taita." He swept his gaze along the ranks of men that reached from the wharf down into the depths of the royal tomb. Those closest to us dropped the chests of bullion they were passing and threw themselves to the ground in obeisance. "Please do not let appearances deceive you, mighty majesty. No ruffians here, all brave men and true warriors of your Egypt." "But what of these ships?" He turned back to study the triremes with intense interest. "How do you account for them?" "Pharaoh, let me take you to a place where we can talk more freely," I implored him. "Oh, very well, Taita. You've always loved your little secrets, have you not?" He strode away towards the gates of the tomb without looking back at me. I followed Pharaoh Tammuz down into his putative father's tomb. He paused as he entered the first treasury chamber, and he studied the stacks of wooden chests that filled the capacious room. I thought he might inquire again about the contents of the chests, but I should have known better that he would not lower his dignity to do so. "It is strange that each of these chests should be branded with the emblem of the Supreme Minos," was all he said, before he walked on into the next chamber, then into the third, where Aton knelt before him. "And it is odder still that my dignified chamberlain should be party to this monkey business of yours, Taita." Pharaoh lowered himself onto an uncompleted stack of the chests, stretched his legs out in front of him, and regarded the two of us with an expression of intense curiosity. "Now tell me, Taita, tell me everything." "Perhaps it is better that I show it to you, Pharaoh," I demurred, and went to the chest I had opened for his sisters. I set the lid aside, and I lifted out the same shining ingot that I had shown to the princesses. I went down on one knee to offer it to him. He took it from my hands and turned it slowly in his own. With his fingertip, he traced the hallmark that was stamped into the metal. Again, this was the rampaging bull of Crete. At last he asked softly, "It has the weight and feel of veritable silver. Surely it cannot be so."
"Surely it can be, and it is, Pharaoh. Every chest you see here is full of the same ingots."
He was silent again for a long time, and under the dust and sun bronzing of his face, I saw him flush with intense emotion. When he spoke again, his voice was hoarse.
"How much is there, Tata?"
He used my familiar name, which was always an expression of his gratitude and affection towards me.
"Every one of these chests is full, Mem."
In return, I used his baby name. I was the only one to whom he ever granted that liberty.
"Stop your silly games. Tell me how much silver you have brought back to me. I am struggling to encompass the magnitude of it."
His tone was still awed.
"Aton and I have weighed the greater part of it," I replied.
"That does not answer my question, Tata."
"We have weighed only the bullion from the first two Minoan ships, and a part of that from the third and last. So far the total is 449 lakhs, Pharaoh. There is probably another 100 lakhs still to be weighed, although it might be as much as 150. Again he was silent, shaking his head and frowning. At last he spoke once more.
"Almost 600 lakhs. That is enough to erect a city twice the size of Thebes, with all its temples and palaces.
And then to build 10,000 ships and still have sufficient left over to fight a dozen wars, my Pharaoh,"
I agreed softly.
"Enough to win back all of your very Egypt from the Hyksos barbarian."
"You have given me the wherewithal to cut down and destroy Bayon and all his multitudes,"
Pharaoh agreed. His voice quickened and rose with the vision of it.
"You're too late, Pharaoh."
Aton came to his feet and moved in front of me to get the attention of Pharaoh.
"Bayon of the Hyksos is dead and drowned already."
He stepped back and pointed at me with a flourish.
"Taita has killed him,"
he declaimed. Pharaoh's gaze swiveled back to me.
"Is this which Aton avows true? Have you killed Bayon, in addition to all your other services to my crown?"
Pharaoh demanded.
I bowed my head in acquiescence. I find boastfulness abhorrent in any man, more especially in myself.
"Tell me about it, Taita. I want every detail of the death of that monstrous animal."
Before I could reply, Aton cut me off.
"Please give me your royal attention once more, my Pharaoh,"
he bowed to the king.
"This is a tale that deserves all your royal attention. After our final triumph over the Hyksos tyrant, it will become part of our glorious military history. Further generations will sing of it to their sons, and the sons to their sons. I beg your majesty to allow me to arrange a triumph this evening, which will be attended by every member of the High Council of State and all your royal family. It will be a triumph during which we will be able to pay due honour to a feat of arms which has probably never been equalled in all our history."
"You are right, Lord Aton. Taita has laid before me a feast that cannot be swallowed in a single gulp. We must savour every mouthful. I must inform my council of this incredible stroke of fortune. 8 of my councillors are ensconced in my palace, in Thebes, near at hand. Lord Kratos follows close behind me from the north, and you, Taita, and Lord Aton are already here. We can assemble the full council within 3 or 4 hours.
"Ample time for you to bathe and rest, my Pharaoh." I glanced down at his attire.
"It is good, honest dirt, Taita, and paid for in Hyksos blood."
Pharaoh grinned at me. "But as so often is the case, you are right. Have my slaves heat the water for my bath." By the time the High Council of Egypt was fully assembled, the third and last trireme had been unloaded, and the bullion from its hold weighed on the balance.
The formal triumph had been prepared, and the sun was setting. I went to inform Pharaoh, expecting him to be resting, to relieve him of the necessity of travelling to his palace and returning again before nightfall. I had ordered that his father's burial chamber be set aside as his temporary lodging. It had never contained a corpse, and so the chamber was not tainted with death. It was a quiet, cool place, and well aired by vents drilled through the rock to the surface. His servants had set up his cot and all his portable campaign furniture here. Far from resting, I found Pharaoh very much awake and alert, pacing the chamber and dictating dispatches to three of his secretaries. He was dressed in a clean uniform, over which he wore a polished bronze breastplate embossed with gold. His hair was freshly washed and curled. He was as handsome as his mother had been beautiful. When I went down on one knee before him, he stopped me, with a hand on my shoulder. "No, Taita," he chided me. "It is my fast intent to make you a nobleman and a member of my inner council before much longer. You must no longer kneel to me. Pharaoh is too gracious. I do not deserve such an honour." I adopted my self-effacing role. "Of course you don't," he agreed. "I do it only to prevent you from endlessly bobbing up and down in front of me. By Seth's ingrowing toenails, as Kratos might say, I swear you make me giddy. Stand up tall and tell me the full tally of the treasure you have garnered for me." "I promised you 600 lakhs, my Pharaoh, but we are 20 lakhs short of that amount." "That is enough, and more than enough, to win me back my kingdom, and for you to keep your head atop your shoulders." At times, the royal sense of humour tends towards the ghoulish. "Are the other members of my council assembled?"
"Every single one of them, including Lord Kratos. He arrived an hour ago. Take me to them."
When we came out through the gates of the tomb, I realized at once the magnitude and extent of what Aton had contrived in my honour. Pharaoh led me down between the ranks of royal guardsmen in full ceremonial uniform to the great tent that had been set up on the bank of the canal. When we entered, his entire court was already there, waiting to greet us. This included the royal family, his 2 sisters and his 22 wives, and his 112 concubines. Then there were the noble lords, his military generals, and the state councillors and their high-ranking staff. Every man and woman in all of Egypt that Pharaoh dared trust with the secret of the Minoan millions was gathered here to greet me. They rose to their feet in unison as we entered, and the men drew their swords to form an arch for Pharaoh and me to pass beneath. At the same time, a massed band of lutes and wind horns in the desert outside the tent burst into a heroic march. It took Pharaoh and me some time to reach the seats that had been prepared for us. Every person in the assembly wanted to touch me, to grip both my hands, and to shower me with compliments and salutations. At close intervals around the wall of the tent stood enormous jars of wine, each of them taller than a man. When at last the entire company was seated, the servants filled large goblets with red wine from the jars and set one in front of Pharaoh. He waved it away. "Taita is the one we are here to honour. Serve him the good red wine, and let him be the first to drink of it." Every eye in the great tent was on me as I came to my feet and raised the goblet towards Pharaoh. "All honour towards Pharaoh. He is our very Egypt. Without Pharaoh and Egypt, we are but dust. All our petty strivings are nothing." I brought the goblet to my lips and I drank a deep draught, while all those lords and ladies came to their feet and shouted my name. Even Pharaoh smiled. I sensed that the less I said, the more they would love me, so I bowed to Pharaoh and sat down again. Pharaoh stood over me and laid his right hand on my shoulder. Then he spoke out in a strong, clear voice that carried to every corner of the great tent. "Lord Taita has met with my favour," he began simply. "He has performed for me and for Egypt a service as great, or greater even, than any man before him. He deserves to be honoured by me and by every Egyptian born and yet to be born. I have elevated him to the nobility. From henceforth he shall be known as Lord Taita of Mekia."
Pharaoh paused, and there was a polite silence, in which most of the illustrious company tried to conceal expressions of mystification.
Mekia is a village on the east bank of the Nile, 30 leagues south of Thebes. It is a cluster of nondescript mud huts, and a population made up of an equally nondescript assortment of specimens of the human race. Pharaoh let us ponder this conundrum for a short while. "I have also granted to him to have and to hold for all time all the royal estate situated on the east bank of the river Nile, between the southern wall of the city of Thebes and the town of Mekia." A gasp of astonishment went up from the assembly. "The river bank from Mekia down to Thebes is 30 leagues of the richest irrigable land in the entire royal estates." In a single breath, Pharaoh had made me one of the 10 richest men in Egypt. I looked suitably stunned and delighted by this magnanimity. However, as I kissed his right hand, the naughty thought did occur to me that, since I had made him one of the richest kings in the world, neither of us had suffered too bitterly by this exchange of favours. Now Pharaoh lifted his silver goblet of wine and smiled around the assembled company. "My queens, my princes and princesses, my lords and ladies, I give you the toast. Here are gratitude, honour, and long life to my lord Taita." They came to their feet, with cups held high, and they shouted out together, "Here are gratitude, honour, and long life to Lord Taita." It was probably the first time in our history that an Egyptian pharaoh had toasted one of his own subjects. But now he resumed his seat and gestured for the rest of the company to do the same. "Lord Aton," he called down the length of the table, "the wine is excellent. I know that the banquet will be no less." Aton has the reputation of being the greatest connoisseur in the land. Some say that this is the main reason he had reached the exalted status of master of the royal household. Reputations are not always deserved. Aton is good, but not the best. The fillets of Nile perch he served had been insufficiently salted, and the desert bustard was a trifle overdone. In addition, he'd allowed the palace chef too liberal a hand with the Baharat spice. If I had been given the task, I suspect that the fare would have been better prepared, but the wine was good enough to dilute these trivial shortcomings. The company was in fine and boisterous fettle by the time Aton rose to introduce the eulogy. I had given passing thought as to which poet I might have chosen if I had been in his sandals. Naturally, I was disqualified from selection by the fact that I was the subject of the composition. So I expected it would probably be either Rezar or Thoyak that Aton had selected for this great honour. In the event, Aton stunned us all, although he gave credit and praise to the recognized bards of Egypt. He tried to justify his final decision by emphasizing the fact that the one he had chosen had been an eyewitness to the actual events. Of course, this was a preposterous idea, since when have the facts been of any great importance to a good story?
"Great Pharaoh and royal ladies, please draw close and lend your ear to a valiant officer of the Blue Crocodile Guards who sailed with Lord Taita." He paused dramatically. "I give you Captain Zaras."
The assembly was unmoving and unmoved as Zaras stepped in through the curtains of the tent and bent the knee to Pharaoh, who looked as surprised as any person present. I thought that I was probably the only one in the assembly who had ever heard of Captain Zaras of the Blue Crocodile Guards. Then something snicked into place in my mind, as neatly as a blade into its scabbard. I glanced quickly at Princess Tehuti, where she was placed between Lord Kratas and Lord Madalek, who was Pharaoh's treasurer. Now she was sitting forward on her stool, with her face aglow, and her expression rapt, staring at Zaras. She was not so blatant as to draw attention to herself by applauding, or in any other manner signifying her approval of Aton's choice. But I knew she had done it. Somehow, she had forced Aton to make this ridiculous decision. I have never underestimated the diplomatic skills of my two princesses, but this seemed to smack of witchcraft. I switched my attention to Bekatha, and I saw instantly that she was part of the conspiracy. From the opposite end of the banquet table, she was rolling her eyes and pulling inane faces, trying to catch her elder sister's attention. Tahuti was studiously ignoring her. I was as angry as I have ever been, but also I was filled with compassion for Zaras. He was a fine young man and a good officer, and I had come to love him as a father might love a son. Now he was standing up before all the world to make himself into a laughingstock. These two heartless royal vixens had contrived this terrible cruelty. I looked back at Zaras. He seemed to be oblivious to the disaster that was rushing down on him. He stood tall and handsome and composed in his uniform. I wished that there was something I could do to save him, but I was helpless. Perhaps he might be able to stumble his way through an awkward recitation like a schoolboy, but forever his efforts would be compared by these strict judges to those of Reza and Thoyak, or even, the gods and goddesses forbid it, to the acclaimed masterpieces penned by my very own hand. Then I was aware of a soft susurration of female voices, a sound like bees on a bed of spring flowers in my garden as they sucked up the nectar. I looked back at the company, and I saw that Tahuti was not the only woman who was appraising Zaras. Some of the older women were even more blatant in their interest. They were smiling and whispering behind their fans. Zaras has never been at court, and thus they had never laid their lascivious eyes upon him before. Then Zaras made a commanding gesture, and the tent went still and quiet, so I could hear a distant jackal wailing out in the desert. Zaras started to speak. I had heard his voice giving orders to his men, commanding them in the din of battle or encouraging them when they faltered, but I had never realized the timbre and depth of it. His voice rang like a bell and soared like the calm sea over the dunes of the desert. It thundered like the storm sea on the reef and soft, like wind in the high branches of the cedar. Within the first few stanzas, he had captivated the entire company. His choice of words was exquisite. Even I could probably not have greatly improved upon them. His timing was almost hypnotic, and his narrative was irresistible. He swept them along like debris caught in the floodwaters of the Nile. When he described the flight of the three arrows with which I slew the Hyksos impostor Baon, all the lords of Egypt leapt to their feet and shouted their acclamation, while Pharaoh seized my upper arm in a grip so fierce that the bruises it left on my flesh persisted for many days thereafter. I found myself laughing and weeping along with the rest of the audience, and in the end I stood up with them to applaud him. As Zaras uttered the final stanza, he turned towards the entrance of the great tent and spread his arms. Then cried aloud noble Taita to all the gods of Egypt and to his pharaoh Tammuz, "This is but a token of the prize I have won for you. This is but a thousandth part of the treasure I lay before you. This is the proof and testimony of the love and duty I bear towards you, Pharaoh Tammuz." Out in the desert, a solemn drum began to beat, and through the entrance of the tent paced 10 armored and helmeted warriors. They bore between them a pallet on which was piled a glittering pyramid of silver bars. As one person, the entire audience came to its feet in a tumult of praise and exultation. "All hail to Royal Pharaoh," they cried, and then, "All honor to Lord Taita."
When he had finished speaking, they would not let Zaras go. Pharaoh spoke with him for several minutes. The men shook his hands or pounded his back, while a few of those women who had taken wine giggled and rubbed themselves against him as a cat will do. When he came to me, we embraced briefly, and I commended him. "Well written and well spoken, Zaras. You are both a warrior and a poet. From a bard of your renown, Lord Taita, I rejoice to hear it said," he replied, and I was touched to see that he meant it. He left me and moved on through the company. He did not make his ultimate destination obvious, but finally he bowed in front of Princess Tuhuti. The two of them were on the far side of the tent from where I sat. However, I am able to read the meaning of words on the lips of others without having heard the sound, as readily as I can read the hieroglyphics on a roll of papyrus. "Shame on you, Captain Zaras. Your poetry made me weep." Those were her first words to him, and they brought him down on one knee before her. His face was turned away from me, so I was unable to see his reply. However, it made Tehuti laugh. "You are gallant, Captain, but I will only forgive you on one condition. That is, if you will promise to sing for us again one day soon." Zaras must have acquiesced, for she went on, "I shall hold you to that promise." He came to his feet and backed away from her respectfully. "Good," I thought. "Come away from there, you silly boy. You are outmatched. You are in deeper danger right now than you will ever be on the field of battle." But Tehuti stopped him with a graceful gesture. "How clumsy of me," I read her lips again. "I seem to have dropped one of my rings. I had it on my finger but an instant ago. Will you find it for me, please, Captain Zaras?" He was as eager as a puppy. He went down at her feet again, searching the ground in front of her. Almost immediately he picked up something, and when he came upright, he was facing half towards me, so I was able to read his lips. "Is this the ring you lost? Your Highness?" "Yes, indeed. That is it. It was given to me by a very special person, the man whom you eulogized so beautifully this very evening." She made no immediate move to take the trinket back from him. "You speak of Lord Taita?" "Indeed," she nodded. "But look at the stone in the ring you are holding. See how clear it is." "It is as clear as water," he agreed, holding the ring to the light of the nearest lantern. She had forced him to examine it minutely, so now she was satisfied, and she held out her hand to him. "Thank you, Captain." He placed the ring in her cupped hand, and she smiled up at him. I thought to myself, "Even if there is no magic in the ring itself, there is sufficient magic in your smile, Princess Tehuti, to bring the walls of both Memphis and Thebes crashing down. How can a callow youth like Zaras possibly resist your wiles?" The first and most urgent task that faced me was to make the three great Cretan triremes disappear without trace. I had to leave no doubt whatsoever in the mind of the supreme Minos of Crete that Baeon of the Hyksos was responsible for the theft of his treasure. His rage would be exacerbated by the knowledge that the culprit was a supposed ally of his. My first thought was to burn the three ships and to throw the ashes into the Nile so that the mystery of their disappearance would be perpetuated for all time. But then I considered the huge amount of timber that I would have to destroy. Egypt is a land almost without substantial forests. For us, timber is almost as valuable as gold and silver. I thought about the warships and chariots I could build from the three trireme hulls, and I could not bring myself to put a torch to such hard-won booty. I discussed this with Pharaoh and Lord Kratas as the supreme commanders of our army. "But where in all of Egypt would you hide that amount of timber, Taita, you old rapscallion?" Kratas demanded. "You've not thought about that, have you?" Pharaoh rallied to my side. "One thing you can be absolutely certain of, my Lord Kratas, is that Taita has thought about it. Taita thinks of everything." "Pharaoh is too kind to me, but I do try my humble best," I murmured. And Kratos roared with mirth at my protestations. "There is nothing humble about you, Taita. Even the smell of your farts is conceited and ostentatious."
Lord Kratos is my favourite lout. In all of Egypt, there is no one who can outdo him in sheer, unmitigated boorishness. I ignored him and addressed myself to Pharaoh. "Pharaoh is right, as ever. I did have a few ideas on the subject. The fact of the matter is that we will have to station a full regiment at the tomb of your deified father, the god Mamos, to guard the silver bullion stored there. The regiment can be made to serve a dual purpose." Even Kratos was listening with attention now.
"Proceed, Taita," Pharaoh urged me.
"Well, Pharaoh, I have remeasured the antechambers to the tomb. If we were to strip the hulls of the triremes down to individual planks, there is space to repack them in those underground chambers where they would be hidden until we had called to use them in some other warlike endeavour." I turned to challenge Kratos.
"No doubt Lord Kratos has a better plan. Perhaps we could take the hulls out into the deep waters of the Red Sea, and my Lord Kratos could sink them for us under the sheer weight of the excrement that issues so profusely from between his noble lips."
"By the nits in Seth's matted pubic hairs, Taita, that's one of your best quips yet. I must remember it,"
Kratos bellowed with laughter. He can take a joke against himself. That's one of the many things about him that I admire. It took many weeks and half a regiment of men to break the triremes down into their individual planks, and then to number each plank and stack them away in the subterranean antechambers. But at last I had completed my disappearing trick, and the great ships had vanished completely. For myself, there was an extra benefit in the subterfuge. I was able to maneuver Pharaoh into placing Zaras in charge of the task of dismantling and storing the ships, with strict orders to remain within the precincts of the tomb until the task was completed. So when both the princesses, Tahuti and Bekatha separately and in concert, inquired after his whereabouts, I was able in all honesty to inform them that Pharaoh had sent him on a very secret military mission, from which he was unlikely to return for some considerable time. The Palace of Thebes was for Zaras a far more dangerous place than any Hyksos battlefield. I lay at night, sweating in terror for my protégé. Quite apart from the fact that I looked upon him as a loyal friend who had risked his life for me, he was an intrepid soldier, a scholar, and now he had revealed himself to be a poet. We had much in common. However, like all men of his age, he had an overriding weakness which was in no way mitigated by the fact that most of the time he kept it out of sight, tucked up under his kilt. I also know just how ruthless and reckless young women can be when their ovaries overheat. My darling little Tehuti's gonads had caught fire at the first sight of him. I could think of no feasible way to quench the flames. In the days that followed my return to Thebes, I found myself overwhelmed by circumstances that assailed me from every direction I turned. Pharaoh demanded my attendance at all hours to discuss the political storm that was boiling up between the Hyksos and the supreme Minos. Aton and I had agreed that in view of the urgency and danger of the situation, we should declare a truce between our rival intelligence operations, and that for the time being we should pool our resources and cooperate with each other for the safety and, perhaps, the ultimate survival of our very Egypt. Strange and nameless men and women appeared and disappeared at our separate doors at all hours of the night, bearing messages and information from the north. Their numbers were only exceeded by those of the carrier pigeons making the same journey. I sometimes fancied that there were so many of our birds aloft at the same time that the sky might actually turn as purple as the colour of their plumage. Aton and I had to examine and discuss every word we received, evaluating it carefully before we relayed it on to Pharaoh and his general staff.
One critical piece of intelligence was a report of the cremation of King Bayon, whom I had arrowed to death in the Nile before Memphis. The Hyksos have the barbaric custom of burning the bodies of their slain heroes to ashes, rather than embalming them, as we more advanced and civilized peoples do. At the same time, they also make human sacrifices to placate their monstrous gods, of which Seth is the chief. Aton and I learned that 100 of our own Egyptian warriors, who had been captured by the Hyksos, were thrown into the flames of Bayon's funeral pyre while they still lived, and that these had been followed by 100 virgins to serve Bayon's pleasure in the other world. Some of these virgins were as young as 5 years of age, just old enough to know what was happening to them as they entered the flames. After hearing this account, how can any sensible person try to argue that the Hyksos are not the basest form of animal life? I was the first person in Thebes to learn that after the cremation of Bayon, his younger brother, Gorab, was crowned as the new king of the Hyksos. Gorab's first concern seemed to have been to avenge the death of his elder brother. He pulled 10,000 of his first-line troops out of the line of battle that faced our Egyptian forces on the border between Sheikh Abada and Asyut. Gorab's decision was a happy one for Egypt. Pharaoh was being bitterly engaged along this entire front. The Hyksos are never parsimonious with the lives of their own troops, and are always prepared to engage in a battle of attrition if the opportunity presents itself. Up until that point, Pharaoh was inflicting heavy losses on Bayon's army, but his own men were taking bitter punishment in return. Now, at a stroke, the pressure was lifted, and Pharaoh was given the opportunity to reconsolidate and make good his position, as Gorab ordered almost a quarter of his army northwards to attack the Cretan force which I had left intact at Tamiat. Gorab had been a witness to his brother's death. He had been the commander of the guards on board the royal barge. He had watched the three Cretan triremes bearing down upon them, and he had seen the Minoan uniforms of the officers and crew as they launched that unprovoked and treacherous attack. Gorab had seen one of the Cretan archers deliberately shoot 3 arrows at his unarmed brother as he struggled in the water. Later, he had retrieved King Bayon's arrow-riddled corpse from the river and wept for him as he set the lighted torch to his cremation pyre. Then he had placed the Hyksos crown on his head with his own hands and declared a full-scale war on Crete. Aton and I followed Gorab's campaign against the Minoans with glee. We learned from our spies that the senior Minoan commanders had sailed back to Crete from Tamiat in the galley that I had left for them. The small galley could accommodate only 40 men. The others were left at the fort. When the galley reached Crete, the commander reported to the Supreme Minos the shameful and dastardly attack by the Hyksos on the fort, and the capture of the Cretan treasure ships. He informed the Minos that the pirates had made no attempt to disguise their identity, but that they had worn full Hyksos uniforms, and he had heard them conversing in that language. The Supreme Minos immediately dispatched a squadron of his war galleys to Tamiat to rescue the 2,000 Cretan troops that were stranded there. However, his ships arrived too late. King Gorab had been there before them with his 10,000. The Cretans put up a gallant resistance, but Gorab slaughtered most of them. The survivors surrendered. Gorab beheaded all of these and made a pyramid of their heads on the wharf below the fort. The relieving squadron arrived from Crete only after King Gorab had returned to Memphis, leaving a pile of human heads rotting in the sun and the vultures devouring what was left of the Minos men. The relieving squadron sailed back to Crete to inform the Minos of the massacre. The Supreme Minos swore an oath of vengeance at the altar of his bizarre gods and sent his fleet to ravage the Hyksos ports and bases along the entire northern African coastline. King Gorab retaliated by conducting a pogrom on all those Minoans living under his sway in northern Egypt.
The Minoans are a clever and industrious people. They are highly skilled in all the crafts and trades. However, they are above all traders and entrepreneurs. Wherever there is the sweet smell of silver and profit, there you will find the Minoans. How else could the inhabitants of such a small island as Crete have become the dominant power in all the lands surrounding the Middle Sea? There were several thousands of the Minoans living in northern Egypt. King Gorab fell upon this local population with all the cruelty and animal ferocity for which the Hyksos are notorious. They dragged the Minoans from their homes and raped the women and children of even the most tender age. Then they herded them, men, women, and infants, into the temples which the Minoans had erected to their gods and burned the roofs down over their heads. Although they tried to flee the country, very few of the Minoans were able to escape. The ships of the Supreme Minos rescued some of the more fortunate ones who lived in the towns and ports along the coast of the Middle Sea. Others who lived further inland escaped into the deserts that enclose our very Egypt. There they died from thirst and from the attentions of the Bedouin, who are also a cruel and rapacious people. However, a few hundred Minoans fled with their families southwards from Memphis and Assuet, and some of these were able to evade the pursuing Hyksos chariots and reach our battle lines. Lord Kratos ordered our men to give the refugees shelter and protection, and to treat them kindly. As soon as I heard of this, I mounted up and rode as swiftly as I was able to the front lines of our legions facing the Hyksos. There were some of our senior commanders in these legions, whom I had known as striplings. I had tutored them in the science of art and war, and my influence had helped to lift them to their present exalted military ranks. Lord Remren had been ennobled by Pharaoh on the battlefield at Thebes, and now he commanded a regiment under General Kratos, the supreme commander. Hui, who had been an outlaw when I captured him, was now a senior officer commanding 500 chariots. All these old friends and acquaintances were delighted to welcome me into their camp, including even that reprehensible old reprobate Kratos, who was commander-in-chief under Pharaoh. On the evening of my arrival, Lord Kratos attempted to drink me insensible. Later, I was one of those who carried him to his cot, and I held his head while he puked it all up. The next morning he thanked me brusquely and sent his orderly officer to parade before me the Minoan refugees who had managed to escape the wrath of King Gorab and reach our lines. There were some 40 or so of these unfortunates. They were a sorry lot, having fled with only meager possessions and with their families decimated by the Hyksos. I moved slowly down their ranks, treating the fugitives with respect and kindness, but also questioning them shrewdly. There was one family group of three huddled together at the furthest end of the line whom I came to at last. The father spoke passable but heavily accented Egyptian. His name was Amytheon. Up until 3 weeks previously, he had been a merchant in Memphis, trading in corn, wine, and leather. He was so successful that even I had heard of him through my agents in that city. The Hyksos had burned his home and warehouse and raped his wife in front of him until she bled to death. His son was 19 years old. His name was Icarion. I liked him immediately. He was tall and strongly built. He had a mop of thick, curling, dark hair and a cheerful face. He had not been overwhelmed and crushed by misfortune, as seemed to be the case with his father. "Of course, you flew from Memphis on wings that you made for yourself?" I asked him. "Of course," replied Icarion. "But I kept well clear of the sun, Lord." He had picked up my allusion to his name immediately. "Can you read and write, Icarion?" "Yes, Lord, although I do not enjoy it as much as my sister does." I looked at his sister, who stood behind the two men of her family, and I studied her face. She was rather pretty, with long, dark hair and a bright, intelligent face, but not as pretty as either of my two princesses. Then again, there are very few who are. "My name is Loxias,
and I am 15 years old. She anticipated my questions. She was almost the same age as my darling Tahuti. Her Egyptian was perfect, as though she had been born to it.
Can you write, Loxias?
Yes, Lord. I am able to do so in all three systems, hieroglyphics, cuneiform, and Minoan script.
She keeps my accounts and writes all my correspondence.
Amytheon, her father interjected.
She is a clever girl.
Can you teach me to speak Minoan and write with Linear A? I asked her. She thought about that for a few moments. Then she replied, Maybe, but it will depend on your ability, Lord Taita. Minoan is not an easy language. I noted her use of my full name and title. It indicated to me that she was as clever as her father boasted she was.
Test me. Say something in Minoan, I invited her.
Very well, she agreed, and then uttered a long sentence of lisping and exotic phrases.
I repeated them. I have a musician's ear for sounds, both instrumental and spoken. I am able to replicate the cadence and accent of any human speech faultlessly. In this case, I had no idea what I was saying, but I said it perfectly. All three of them looked startled, and Loxias flushed with annoyance.
You are mocking me, Lord Taita.
You do not need my tutelage. You speak it almost as well as I do, she accused me. Where did you learn? I smiled mysteriously and left her guessing. I commandeered horses from Hui's regiment, and the four of us rode south to Thebes that same day. I found comfortable accommodation for the little lost family a short walk outside the city walls, in one of the small villages on my newly granted Mekia estate. I spent several hours every day with Loxias, learning to speak and write in Minoan. Within a very few months, Loxias admitted that there was nothing more she could teach me.
The pupil has outstripped the teacher. I think that probably there is much you can teach me, Lord Taita.
My two princesses were not such eager or adept students as I was. In the beginning, they were both adamant that they wanted nothing to do with such a stupid and uncouth language as Minoan, nor did they wish any truck with a Minoan peasant girl of humble birth. They informed me that this was their joint decision, and that it was absolutely final and irreversible, and there was nothing I could do about it. Tahuti did all the talking, and her little sister stood by and nodded her head in concurrence. I went to speak with their big brother, Pharaoh Tammuz. I outlined for him the necessity of us Egyptians developing and exploiting our burgeoning relationship with Crete, and how this depended, in a large measure, upon the ability of the two girls to communicate with the supreme Minos and his courtiers. Then I set out in detail the plans I had for his sisters. Pharaoh sent for the two little rebels and remonstrated with them. He ended this one-sided discourse with such dire and convincing threats that even I was worried that he might carry them out. The princesses forthwith reversed their absolutely final decision. But for several days thereafter they sulked at me with a practiced intensity. Their rancor was rapidly set aside when I set up a prize for the student who showed the most improvement over the previous week, as judged by their new language teacher, Loxias. The prize was always a piece of highly desirable feminine frippery, which Amytheon found for me in the bazaars of the city. Soon they were able to chatter, argue, and emote in fluent Minoan, and Loxias exceeded her brief by teaching them a number of words and expressions that were better suited to the taverns and brothels of the city slums than to the palace. Over the following months, these three little hellions delighted in shocking me with these utterances. They soon became such a closely knit trio that the princesses took Loxias to live with them in the royal harem.